when you think about the book of Genesis, what passages and stories come to your mind? For some of you, perhaps nothing. And that's fine. We're glad you're here. If you're completely unfamiliar with the book of Genesis, that's perfectly okay by me. I'm glad that you'll hear it opened up if you keep on coming back for the next several months. And you'll hear, perhaps for the first time, the stories and the truths that are in this marvelous book. But some of you out there have heard these stories from the book of Genesis from as long as you can remember, from the time you were just a little child. And some of you who are little children right now know a lot of these stories in the book of Genesis. So what comes to your mind? If I just say Genesis, what's in it? What comes to your mind? Creation? Fall? Flood? We've talked about those so far. Tower of Babel, that's this morning. Abraham and Sarah, destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah, birth of Isaac, finding of a wife for Isaac, Jacob and Esau, their birth, their confrontation with each other, Jacob going off, working for his wife for so many years, his wives, Jacob's return, Penuel, his dream, the ladder going up to heaven. Jacob's 12 sons, Joseph being sold into slavery, all that happens in Egypt. Think about that list and any others that come to your mind when you think about Genesis. They're really two very different types of stories in that list. Creation. Fall, flood, the whole world is involved. God interacting with the entirety of the creation. And then, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Joseph, Judah. One particular family line, four generations in one family. Why such a stark contrast? On the one hand, at the beginning of the book, all these things that have to do with all of the earth, and then, for the bulk of the book, just following one family through several generations. Why? Why is the book structured this way? Why is the book made up of stories that are so different from each other? Was this just some chronicler of old who had these old accounts and just kind of slapped them together and so they're completely unrelated to each other? Well, note that this is not just true of Genesis. The large bulk of the entire Bible concerns only Abraham and his descendants. Other peoples come in, the Babylonians and the Assyrians and the Arameans, etc., but only as they relate to the descendants of Abraham. And it's not really until we get all the way to the end of the book, to the book of Revelation, that the focus once again shifts primarily to every tribe and tongue and people and nation. So we have Genesis 1 to 11 on the entire world. We have Genesis 12, or the very last few verses of Genesis 11, Genesis 12, all through the whole rest of the Bible, until we get to Revelation, focusing mainly on Abraham and his descendants. And even amongst Abraham's descendants, just one line of Abraham's descendants. Why? Why is that? Genesis 12 is a hinge in the book of Genesis and in the entire Bible. from the focusing on the entire world to now focusing on Abraham and his descendants. Does God give up on the rest of mankind? Does he just say, all those people are just hopeless, forget about them, I'm only going to deal with this one group of people that I can have some impact on? Is that what he's doing? Or does God have another plan in mind? Well, to answer these questions, we'll look at today's text, Genesis 10, 11, and the first three verses of Genesis 12, under three headings. We'll look, first of all, at the nations multiplied in chapter 10. And then the nations rebellious and dispersed in chapter 11, verses 1 to 9. And then the nations blessed in chapter 11, verse 10, to chapter 12, verse 3. And we'll see, in case you fall asleep, I don't want you to miss this point. We'll see that God always has a plan for the nations. From the beginning. And he works through Abraham to bring about that plan for the nations. And that plan is close to fulfillment even today. The nations multiply. Recall that prior to the flood, in Genesis 6:5, we read that God sees that every intention of the thoughts of man's heart is only evil all the time. And so God judges the world. He destroys everything living except Noah and seven of his family members, along with a pair from every animal and bird. We emphasized last week that this is a story of God's grace. God's grace to those who deserve his judgment and condemnation. We also noted that God was not trying to now get a pure line that would not be stained with sin. Noah was stained with sin, and we see that in chapter 9. Instead, what God was doing was giving a picture of the future final judgment of the world, where there is only one ark that is for salvation, and that is Jesus Christ. There's no other way to be saved from that final condemnation of the world but to join the ark of Jesus Christ. And so, since God is not trying to purify the earth through the flood, he is instead giving a picture of the final end of the earth. He promises he is never again going to do a worldwide judgment until the very end. Never again will a flood cover the earth. Once is enough as a picture of the final judgment. But God shows his grace in the ark to these men and women who did not deserve to be saved from the flood. God saves them by his grace and gives this marvelous picture of Noah living by faith in the God who promised him that he was going to send a flood and that he was going to preserve him and his family through it. Well, chapter 9, Noah sins, his son Ham then sins, and one of Ham's four sons, Canaan, then bears Noah's curse because of this sin. And the descendants of Canaan then become like the family line of Cain. Remember that back in chapter 4? The descendants of Canaan become like the family line of Cain, representative of all of those who are opposed to God. They're not the only people who are opposed to God. And perhaps not all of them as individuals are opposed to God, but they are representative of the seed of the serpent. They are representative of those who see God and do not want him to be over them. And then at this point, after the flood, God gives Noah and his family the same command he gave to Adam and Eve in the garden, remember? Be fruitful and multiply, teem on the earth, and multiply in it. Well, chapters 10 and 11 tell us the fulfillment of that command. Chapter 10. Now, you don't need to raise your hand, but think in your head. How many of you have read through the entire Bible? I know that a number of you have. But how many of you, when you came to Genesis 10 and similar passages, read it kind of like this? These are the generations of the sons of Noah, Shem, Ham, Japheth. Sons were born to them after the flood. The sons of Japheth, Gomer, Magog, Madai, Javan, Tubal, Meshach, Tirith. The sons of Gomer, Ashkenaz, Riphath, Tokhmah. The sons of Javan, Elisha, Tarshish, Kittim, Dodan. And just kind of let your eyes go over all those names and all those words, you know. Whew, check that off. When you see a list like this, ask the question, what is God doing here? Ask Him that question. What are you doing here, Lord? Why are all these names here? How is this tied in to the story that you are telling? Let me direct you back again to chapters 4 and 5. Remember, we did pick up some important things from the genealogies in chapters 4 and 5. I want to go through this just real quickly and point out a couple of things. In chapters 4 and 5, the descendants of Cain are those who are symbolic of the descendants of the seed of the serpent. The descendants of Seth are symbolic of the seed of the woman, those who are godly. Those who are descendants of Cain, like Lamech, remember, are those who are trying to build up their own name through earthly accomplishments and through violence, versus those who are the seed of Seth, are those who call on the name of the Lord and walk with God, like Enoch. That was chapter 4 and 5. What about here in chapter 10 and then in chapter 11? Is something similar going on? Well, note the structure. Here we have three sons, not two. Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Look at your Bibles if you have one. Verse 2 of chapter 10 gives the beginning of the genealogy of Japheth. Seven sons and seven grandsons. Seven's an important number. Verse 6, we start with the genealogy of Ham. And he actually talks more about Ham's descendants than any others in this chapter. Verse 21, we get to the descendants of Shem. Notice the similarity between this set of genealogies and the earlier one. Last in line is the line of the promise. The line of the promise. Notice that the genealogy of Shem, the descendants of Shem, picks up again in chapter 11, verse 10, after the Tower of Babel. Why? Look at verse 25 of chapter 10. To Eber, this is the man from whom we get the name Hebrew, to Eber were born two sons. The name of the one was Peleg, for in his days the earth was divided. That's talking about the Tower of Babel. And his brother's name was Joktan. Joktan fathered Almadad, Shelef, Hazarmaveth, Jerah. Now notice, we're not told anything about the sons of Peleg here in chapter 10. But in chapter 11, we go back to Shem and trace the genealogy of Abraham from Shem down to Abraham via Peleg. Why? Not all the sons of Shem are in the line of promise, just like not all of Jacob's children are going to be in the line of promise. Not all of Isaac's children are in the line of promise. Even though Shem's line is representative of the children of promise, even though this line is representative of those who are godly, Joktan's descendants are listed right before the Tower of Babel account, implying that they were part of this, that they joined the descendants of Ham in this rebellion against God. So that's a few points to read from the structure. Look now at a couple of things under the descendants of Canaan. Chapter 10, verse 8. Cush fathered Nimrod. He was the first on earth to be a mighty man. He was a mighty hunter before the Lord. Therefore it is said, like Nimrod, a mighty hunter before the Lord. The beginning of his kingdom was Babel, Erech, Akkad, and Calneh in the land of Shinar. From that land he went into Assyria and built Nineveh, Rehoboth-ir, Calah, and Rezin, between Nineveh and Calah. That is the great city. Now again, this might just seem like superfluous detail, but if you look through all the descendants of Shem, verses 21 to 31 of chapter 10, and then chapter 11, verses 10 to 32, what do you see? Not a single earthly accomplishment is mentioned. Remember, we saw that same thing in the genealogy of Cain and the genealogy of Seth. All the earthly accomplishments were noted under Cain. Well, here, all the earthly accomplishments are noted under Ham's descendants. Again, I think this is for the same purpose. Those in the line of promise know what's important. It's not that they have no earthly accomplishments, but that that's not what they are remembered for. Their name is made great, not because he's a mighty hunter or because he builds a city. Their name is made great because they are people of God. And that's what they are to be remembered for. Well, finally, on this genealogy, count. I already noted that Japheth has seven sons who are listed, that only the grandchildren of two of his sons are mentioned, so that we have seven there also. Seven is a number of completeness. This gives us an indication that this is a stylized genealogy. Not that it's untrue, but that there is much that is left out. And the names are given in order to highlight symbolically certain things. Japheth is completing his purpose of filling the earth and multiplying. 777. You notice the descendants of Canaan, you won't see any groups of seven there. Note also verse 4 of chapter 10. The descendants of Japheth in this verse are said to be Elisha and Tarshish. Those are two places. Those aren't people. And then Kittim and Dodanim. These are peoples, not individuals. And we notice that several places. The idea is that, again, he's not giving a list only of individuals. There are individuals here, there are people groups. What he's doing is instead giving a table of nations. And if you count, and you're always supposed to count when you're reading the Hebrew Bible, if you count all of the descendants of Shem, Ham, and Japheth who are listed, you know how many there are? 70. 70. 7 times 10. 7 and 10 are both numbers for completeness. And so these 70 are a picture of the entire table of nations. All the nations that God has created are pictured here in this chapter. Note also, Israel is not one of them. At this point, Israel does not yet exist as a nation. And so here, at this hinge in the book of Genesis, at this hinge really in the entire Bible, God is saying, I am concerned for the entirety of the nations. These are all mine. And now I'm going to zero in and work with one people group, but always my plan is to bring all of these nations under my umbrella, under my authority, and to bring them into my joy. That's what he's doing here. That's what he's doing. So despite man's rebellion and sinfulness, and that's partly pictured here, it's pictured more in chapter 11, God enables the people to fulfill the command to multiply and fill the earth, and he shows his concern for all the peoples of the world. Well, that's the nations multiplied. Now let's move to the nations rebellious and dispersed. Look at chapter 11. This is more familiar, these first nine verses, more familiar than the rest of chapters 11 and 10. Now the whole earth had one language and the same words. And as people migrated from the east, they found a plain in the land of Shinar and settled there. And they said to one another, come, let us make bricks and burn them thoroughly. And they had brick for stone and bitumen for mortar. Then they said, come, let us build ourselves a city and a tower with its top in the heavens, and let us make a name for ourselves, lest we be dispersed over the face of the whole earth. Now, what command had God given these people? Be fruitful, multiply, fill the earth. Are they filling the earth? No. Their plan is to all concentrate in one place to build a city and to make a name for themselves, lest we be dispersed. God's command was to disperse. But they're not doing that. They instead are staying all in the same place. And they are looking to make a name for themselves, to make themselves great, to find greatness in themselves, in their accomplishments, rather than to find greatness by walking with God as Enoch did. So they have rejected God's plan for them. They're trying to build a tower up to heaven so that they might be up with God. We do the same. Whenever we seek to find security or to find fame or to find accomplishment apart from God, we too are rejecting God's plan for us. Well, the first phrase in verse 5 is the literary center of this story. You have people rebelling, and verse 5, what happens? But the Lord came down. And once God comes down, everything changes. Notice that these people think they're building a tower up to heaven, but God actually has to come down to see it. They don't quite make it, right, all the way to heaven. Verse 5, and the Lord came down to see the city and the tower which the children of man had built. And the Lord said, behold, they are one people, and they have all one language, and this is only the beginning of what they will do, and nothing that they propose to do will now be impossible for them. If they are one people united in their rebellion against God, they will continue to work together against God's good purposes for them. They will work together to reject the line of God's Redeemer. And so God, for their own good, disperses them. This is not a judgment which has a negative impact on them. This is a judgment that then allows today the missionary endeavor to take place. He separates, he in effect divides so that he might later conquer each group individually.
Verse 7.
Come, let us go down and there confuse their language so that they may not understand one another's speech. So the Lord dispersed them from there over the face of all the earth, and they left off building the city. Therefore its name was called Babel, because there the Lord confused the language of all the earth, and from there the Lord dispersed them over the face of all the earth. He made them fulfill his command for them. Now think about this. What was the goal of these people? They wanted to make a name for themselves. Question. What are their names? Isn't it interesting that in two chapters full of names, not one name is given of the people who build the Tower of Babel? They're all forgotten. They're all anonymous. They are without names. They are without names. Also, what these people were trying to call their city was Gate of God. Gate of God. But the name that we know this by, which sounds like Gate of God in the language Akkadian, in Hebrew sounds like confusion. And so what we remember the Tower of Babel by is the word confusion and not Gate of God. So seeking to make a name for themselves, these people become nameless. Seeking to make a city so that they might not be dispersed, they are dispersed. And not only are they dispersed, but now they're separated so they cannot even understand each other. So the nations multiplied, the nations rebellious and dispersed. Let's turn now to the nations blessed. The rest of chapter 11 documents the genealogy from Shem to Abraham. I'm not going to read that to you, but if you notice it, you're given ages here, what happens? Each generation, the life is shorter and shorter and shorter, so that in the harsh conditions that prevail following the flood, even the line of the promised Redeemer suffers. Sin impacts them too. But in the midst of their rebellion, in the midst of the rebellion of these people, God continues to fulfill his promise to Eve. Let's pick up reading with verse 27 of chapter 11. Now these are the generations of Terah. Terah fathered Abram, Nahor, and Haran. And Haran fathered Lot. Haran died in the presence of his father Terah in the land of his kindred in Ur of the Chaldeans. And Abram and Nahor took wives. The name of Abram's wife was Sarai, and the name of Nahor's wife Milcah, the daughter of Haran, the father of Milcah and Iscah. Now Sarai was barren, she had no child. Terah took Abram his son, and Lot the son of Haran, his grandson, and Sarai his daughter-in-law, his son Abram's wife, and they went forth together from Ur of the Chaldeans to go into the land of Canaan. But when they came to Haran, they settled there. The days of Terah were 205 years, and Terah died in Haran. So we've now moved from our focus on all the world, from our focus on all the nations, to focusing on Abraham. We've swung that hinge, and we're no longer in the story of the entire world. We're now focused in on the line of the Redeemer. Abram and Sarai are husband and wife. Yet in verse 30 we're told they do not have a child. And those of you who've read the book of Genesis know that this is the central feature of this book, that Abram and Sarai, who are the ones through whom God promises his Redeemer, have no child. If this is the line of the Redeemer, God's going to have to do something. Note also, verse 31, that when Abram leaves Ur of the Chaldeans, he goes with his father. and his father is intending to go to Canaan. But he never makes it. He settles in Haran and he dies there. Did God call Terah? And he rejected the call? Was Abraham slow to respond? It does seem that Abram at this point was slow to respond to God's call. Those questions aren't answered clearly. But in any event, Abram's father dies apart from God's promised land. Genesis 12. Now the Lord said to Abram, "Go from your country and your kindred and your father's house to the land that I will show you. And I will make of you a great nation, and I will bless you and make your name great, so that you will be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and him who dishonors you I will curse, and in you all the families of the earth shall be blessed." What does God call Abram to do? To leave. To leave all that he knows, to leave all his security, to leave all of his family. To go where? He doesn't say. Did you get that? He doesn't tell him. He just says, "Go and I'll show you the place. Go. Take a step this direction and I'll show you where you're supposed to end up." Abraham has to walk by faith. He has to live by faith. God doesn't tell him where he's going. But in verses 2 and 3, although he doesn't tell Abram where he's going, he gives him a sevenfold promise. And it's not an accident that there are seven parts of this promise. But note that all of these promises are future. None of them does God fulfill right then. He calls him and he says, "Go, and I will. He gives him seven promises, but none of them are fulfilled immediately. "I will make you a great nation," promising descendants to him. And of course, at the moment, he has none. "I will bless you," says God. "Third, I will make your name great." People of the power were trying to make their own name great. That won't work. But if God makes your name great, it's going to be great. His name, we do remember. Fourth, so that you will be a blessing. I will make your name great so that you will be a blessing. Not that so you will be famous. I'm not telling you to go so that you will be comfortable. I'm not telling you to go so that you can be secure. I'm telling you to go, and I'm calling you, and I'm blessing you so that you might be a blessing. So that my plan, says God, might be fulfilled through you. That's why you're blessed, Abraham. That's why you're blessed, Desiring God Community Church. So that you might be a blessing. That's what God always does. He blesses us so that we might bless others. Psalm 67 that we read. God bless us, cause your face to shine upon us, so that your ways may be known to all the earth. God blesses you so that you can show his love, so that you can be Christ-like, so that as God is, so might you be in the world, says the Apostle John. The purpose of God's blessing is so that you might serve. And as we all live that out, the gospel spreads to those who are near and those who are far. As those of us whom he has blessed so much by giving us the Holy Spirit in our hearts, by opening our eyes to the truth of the gospel, by giving us material abundance, so that those of us whom he has blessed so much might be a blessing to all the nations, those near and those far. Do you see that? Are you living that out? Number five, I will bless those who bless you. So the blessing is multiplicative. Number six, I will curse those who curse you. God says here, Abram, you are my representative. And when people reject you, they're rejecting me. To be of one purpose with you, Abram, is to be of one purpose with me. And then finally, seventh, in the most important location, God says this, in you all the families of the earth shall be blessed. In you, all that table of the nations that we just saw in chapters 10 and 11, all of those rebellious people, descendants of Ham and Canaan, all the families of the nations will be blessed in you. Even those families of those individuals who curse you, whom I will curse. All the families of the nations will be blessed in you. Think of a child who, like me when I was about 6 years old, goes through an open window of a neighbor's house and takes candy out of the candy jar. Whose father then thanks him memorably, making the sin clear. But then this father takes the child into his arms and says, I am your father, and I love you, and I will meet your deepest need. I will meet your deepest need. There is no reason for stealing. I will meet your deepest need. Just so here. Just so here. God relates the rebellion of the peoples and his dispersing them around the earth to keep them from being strong in their rebellion, so that over the centuries and millennia, he might bring them to himself. So that through the descendants of Abraham, every one of those tribes and tongues and people and nation might come to cherish Jesus Christ. God will reach them, one by one by one, people group by people group by people group, so that Psalm 67 will be fulfilled. Let the peoples praise you, O God. Let all the peoples praise you. Let the nations be glad and sing for joy. So that the end of time, as we read, those from every tribe and tongue and people and nation will gather around the throne and cry out in joy to the promised seed of Abraham, salvation belongs to our God who sits on the throne and to the Lamb, to the seed of Abraham, to the Lamb. So this is the hinge. This is the hinge in the book of Genesis, the hinge in the entire Bible. The story of the descendants of Abraham begins here. It's all one plan from God's working through Abraham all the way through David, through the exile in Babylon, through the return of the people, through Mary and the incarnation, through the teaching, the crucifixion, the resurrection, the coming of the Holy Spirit at Pentecost, the spread of the gospel outside of Jerusalem, to Judea and to the uttermost ends of the earth, to the book of Revelation, and the new heavens and the new earth. It's all one story, one plan that God put into action back here in Genesis. In Genesis chapter 12. Picking out Abraham as the father of this line of people through whom he would send Jesus Christ. Out of all the peoples dispersed at Babel, out of all the confused languages, out of all the rebellious and hard-hearted peoples, God creates a perfect, spotless bride for himself. Abraham is called to go out where God will show him, to be blessed so that he might be a blessing. So are you. So am I. Go to the place that I will show you. And all of us together, in all of us together, all the families of the earth shall be blessed. So do you see the plan? Do you see how God has worked all things together for all these centuries so that he might bring all the nations to himself? Do you see how from the beginning, right here in the book of Genesis, God reveals his heart and his desire for all the nations to come to himself? Do you see how God worked through Abraham and his descendants so that he might be a blessing to all others? Do you see how God took one nation and from that nation brought forth the Redeemer, Jesus Christ, the Son of God, the Son of Abraham? And do you see how that one man brings all people together into one glorious bride for himself? Do you see how he has worked in you for that very purpose? We flashed our mission statement up here before the beginning of the service. We exist to spread a passion for the supremacy of God in all things, for the joy of all peoples. That's the reason for our existence as a church. Spreading the worship of God among all the peoples of the earth for God's glory and their joy. How are you fulfilling the reason for your existence? Maybe you're not yet a part of that community of worshipers. Maybe if you died right now, you would not join that multitude around the throne praising God for all eternity. You can. You can. You can be a part of that group. Throw yourself before this God. Throw yourself before the God who has planned from all eternity to bring those from all these nations to himself. Throw yourself before this God of mercy who loves you, who wants you as part of his precious bride. Confess that Jesus is Lord of all and ask him to be your husband, your desire. And then ask how you can be involved in reaching the nations for him. Maybe you're a believer already. And if you are, join the movement. Join the movement. God gives us this tremendous privilege of being his agents and messengers. Spread the passion. Encourage those who are going out. Help train up others who can go out and consider whether you should go yourself. Fulfill the reason for your existence, bringing all the nations into the white-hot enjoyment of God himself.